Good morning. My name is Blair Kaufman, and I am a senior anthropology major at Dickinson College. And on behalf of the Department of Anthropology and the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues, I would like to welcome you to today's symposium on transnational gender and sexuality. Throughout the course of the day, we will hear three scholars who will present their perspectives, critically exploring sexuality and gender identities in relation to shifting cultural and national boundaries. We begin this morning with Denise Brennan, who will present a lecture entitled Love Work and Sex Work in the Dominican Republic. Dr. Brennan is an associate professor of anthropology in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Her interests include the global sex trade, human trafficking, migration, women's labor, and Latin America and the Caribbean. Dr. Brennan is the author of What's Love Got to Do With It? Transnational Desires and Sex Tourism in the Dominican Republic. In 2004, Dr. Brennan was awarded an American Association of University Women Fellowship to conduct her current research on trafficking and recovery in the United States. The symposium will continue at 1 p.m. when France Wittens-Twine of the University of California, Santa Barbara, will present her paper, Written on the Body, Hair and Heritage in Black Europe. At 2:30 p.m., Professor Anne Hill of the Department of Anthropology will present the work of Karen Kelski of the University of Illinois, a paper entitled The Personal is Personal, Predicaments of the Lesbian Feminist Subject in Japan. The day will conclude at 4:30 p.m. with a panel discussion including Brennan, Twine, and Professor Hill. All sessions will be held here in the Stern Center Great Room, and we hope that you will all join us. At this time, I would like to ask that you disable all electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end. Because the program is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Denise Brennan.
Good morning. Can you see me over the podium? What a wonderful day. You students are so lucky. This is a really cool topic. And I've had the wonderful experience of meeting my fellow panelists this morning. I can tell you it's going to be a really inspiring day. I am going to read a paper. This is something we anthropologists do when we go to our own professional meetings. We don't usually speak extemporaneously. And it's from my first book on sex work in the Dominican Republic. And later in the panel, I look forward to talking about my current work on trafficking to the United States. And I want to thank the Anthropology Department and the Clark Forum for bringing us together and giving us all a chance to explore these ideas about gender and globalization and transnationalism. So very fitting, it's Valentine's Day, and this paper's about love work. This paper explores the shifting meanings and practices of sex, marriage, and romantic love in a sex tourist destination in the Dominican Republic. I argue that in a place where sex and tourism are the main industries, what I call a sexscape, sex and love between foreigners and Dominicans take on new meanings and purposes. Of course, love cannot be measured or proved in any setting, but what is of interest in this paper is that practices that are assumed to indicate romantic love in many cross-cultural settings are suspected of having other purposes in the tourist setting. No relationship between foreigners and Dominicans escapes scrutiny. After all, successful performance of love can lead to marriage, which can lead to legal migration off the island. In this context of transnational desires and economic ambitions, these relationships become fodder for the gossip mill. So, are they really in love? Is a common response by both Dominicans and foreign residents living in Sosua, a tourist town on the north coast, when they hear about a relationship between a Dominican and a foreigner. The possibility of love for migration is mentioned almost immediately and then either waved away or confirmed. In Sosua, we see how Dominicans may try to maximize sexual opportunities and use marriage as a migration strategy. Marriage in a tourist economy, especially in an internationally known sex tourist destination, often has nothing to do with emotion-driven love or romance. In fact, in Sosua, Sosuans talk about two kinds of marriage that grow out of different understandings and uses of love. There is marriage por amor and marriage por residencia. Marriage por amor, the real thing, is understood by Sosuans in the context of Sosua as sexscape, as driven by romance and emotional needs rather than strategy and financial needs. Marriage por residencia, or for a visa. At the discos, bars, and beaches, any Dominican can meet and perhaps marry a foreigner. Love takes on multiple meanings when resort workers, men and women, female sex workers, and men known as Sankey Pankeys try to parlay their access to foreign tourists into marriage proposal and visa sponsorships. This paper recounts how sex workers and former sex workers marry individuals as a strategy to get ahead. They use the discourse and practices of romantic love to secure marriage proposals for a visa. Why waste a marriage certificate on romantic love when it can be transformed into a visa? In Sosua, there's a kind of sexual labor continuum onto which we can map times in poor women's lives when they might work in the formal sex trade, as well as other times when former sex workers might build transactional sexual relationships outside the formal sex trade. This continuum of women's strategic use of sexual labor and of love work, the title of today's talk, underscores how difficult it is for poor women to get themselves and their families out of poverty. Now, I'd like to just say a few words about my field research. So, as you know, anthropologists, we usually go places, sometimes it can be down the street where we live, and we try to live with who live like the folks we're writing about. So, starting in 1993, when I was a grad student, I went to the Dominican Republic, and I worked with a small Dominican non-governmental organization that does HIV prevention and outreach work, using what is known as a peer education model, which means that they pay sex workers and former sex workers to do outreach in brothels and boarding houses. So I followed these women around and met sex workers and did about 10 years of field work back and forth to the Dominican Republic. So that's what my book is based on in the paper today. Anthropologist Linda Ann Rayboon aptly expresses just how difficult it is to do research on love because of the, quote, slippery nature of emotions. She writes, now conscious, now unconscious, now openly expressed, now indirectly expressed, and always manipulated. Even though sex workers in Sosua talk about the possibility of marriage por amor, I only rarely heard sex workers describe having experienced this kind of emotion-driven love as opposed to strategy-driven love. Rather, sex workers' descriptions of what they want in relationships, in marriage, or in consensual unions with either foreign or Dominican men center not on emotions but on financial security. For Sosua's sex workers, choosing to fall in love with one man over another is a rational process with serious material consequences. Contrary to the notion of falling in love as a kind of elation that comes with losing controls of one's senses or wits, for these women, being in love or pretending to be in love requires alertness, savvy, and determination. Rayboon comments on this idea that in the U.S. we, quote, tend to believe that sentiment is genuine only if it is spontaneous. Conventional, required, manipulated sentiment seems false, and its falseness morally reprehensible. But, continues Rayboon, deliberation and requirement are as much a part of emotion as spontaneity. Some relationships in Sosua are not easily described. Many that start out as transactional by one or both parties can transform into something else entirely. In the sex trade in particular, the line between love and money can become very fuzzy, as Yosan Sambat has observed in relationships between Thai sex workers and white-skinned Westerners. In fact, many sex workers and resort workers in Sosua hope for romantic love, even when they doubt the authenticity of the relationships around them. Sosuans understand, indeed expect, that many relationships beginning in their town, are strategic performances on the part of Dominicans. Their skepticism about love emerges from Sisuan's knowledge that, in Arlie Hochschild's language, active emotional labor is involved, indeed demanded, in jobs at hotels, bars, and nightclubs. If we focus simply on the exchange of sex for money or goods in Sisua, we will miss, quote, this is from Hochschild, a sense of the active emotional labor involved in the selling. Sisuans know that many sex workers and former sex workers now working at restaurants and hotels are hard at work selling romance and love along with the other services that they deliver. Sisua sex workers' transactional use of marriage is an ages-old story. What is new is how marriage as transaction operates in a globalized world where legal crossing of national borders requires passports and visas. In Sisua's sexscape, marriage between Dominicans and Europeans, usually Germans, emerges as an economic strategy as well as a legal route to securing the papers necessary to migrate off the island. Within what Constance Clark calls the politics of border crossing, research on so-called mail-order brides vividly describes how marriage to foreigners is often the only viable option for legal migration for citizens of certain countries. For example, young Chinese women are able to gain the exit visas and passports that most Chinese spend years waiting for or never get by marrying men from Japan or Singapore through marriage introduction agencies. Research on marriage as transactions, such as Nicole Constable's work on marriage introduction agencies, throws into relief Western culture-bound assumptions about what constitutes a good marriage. It also demonstrates that the Western white and middle-class feminist critique of marriage is based on traditional division of labor, does not consider the calculus of women who have, as Constable writes, worked in fields or a factory for subsistence since childhood. For them, marriage, even marriages that take the most traditional forms and are not based on love, can be a vacation from backbreaking work and daily financial crises. With their own workload lightened, Constable describes how, for example, working class or rural Filipinas' workdays may involve a combination of hard work, quote, in shops, factories, or rice fields, combined with domestic chores and responsibilities for an extended household. Their material comfort improved, and the possibilities to remit money back to their families expanded. Marriage for migration and economic security can be good enough. Love may not be missed. Although some Dominican sex workers ideally might hope for love and greater gender equity in the household as an alternative to Dominican machismo, within marriage to foreign men, most regard these marriages strictly as business transactions. I cannot attempt to determine which relationships were rooted in emotion or which grew out of strategy. However, when sex workers told me their own relationships were based on strategy and not on emotion, the guessing game was removed. Elena, a former sex worker, laughed when I asked if she was in love with the German man she had married in the spring of 2001. She said to me, "You know how it is. It's not love. My children and I will have more opportunities in Germany." However, it is important to keep in mind the various motivations that could shape self-reporting on love. Positing love could make Sisuan sex workers appear foolish. No matter what they feel for their foreign boyfriends, these women have an incentive to portray themselves as not naive enough to actually fall in love. Elena, for example, had earlier been abandoned by another German man, Jürgen, with whom she had set up a household in Sisua and had a son. This relationship defies easy categorization, but at times it seemed to be based on emotion and at other times on strategy. Later in the paper, I'll examine some more recent turn of events in Elena's romantic and economic life. Since Sisuan sex workers and former sex workers do not see marriage to foreign men as ending other romantic and sexual relationships, they know they still can share love and engage in sex they enjoy with other partners. Sex workers maintain relationships with Dominican and foreign men while they are married to foreign husbands. Historian Lauren Derby's description of the complex and contradictory structure of the Dominican family as, she writes, characterized by concubinage, serial unions, female-headed households, de facto polygamy, helps explain why Susuan sex workers do not conceive of marriage as either restricting their sexual life or as permanent. Nor do they necessarily imagine living their life out in Europe, but rather know they can always return to the Dominican Republic, especially after accumulating some savings. So a few words about this idea of sexscapes. With its constant influx of Dominican and Haitian migrants for work in the sex and tourist trades, and of European tourists for play, as well as a large foreign resident community living there year-round, Sosua has become a transnational sexual meeting ground. Since Sosua has become known as a place where tourists can buy sex, Sosua and Sosuans have experienced monumental changes. Because sex tourism has played a critical role in the town's transformation, I see it as a space inextricably tied up with transactional sex. It has become a sexscape of sorts. I use the term sexscape to refer to both the new kind of global sexual landscape and the sites within it. The word sexscape builds on the five terms Arjun Appadurai has coined to describe landscapes that are the building blocks of, quote, imagined worlds. He writes, the multiple worlds that are constituted by the historically situated imaginations of persons and groups spread around the globe. He uses the suffix scape to allow us, quote, to point to the fluid, irregular shapes of these landscapes with terms such as ethnoscapes, mediascapes, technoscapes, financescapes, and ideoscapes. As he considers the relationships among these five dimensions of global cultural flows. Sex for sale is one more dimension of global cultural flows, and Sosua is one site within a global economy of commercialized sexual transactions. Sexscapes link the practices of sex work to the forces of a globalized economy. I see their defining characteristics as the following. International travel from the developed to the developing world, consumption of paid sex, and inequality. In a sexscape such as Sosua, there are differences in power between the buyers, the sex tourists, and the sellers, sex workers, that can be based on race, gender, class, and nationality. These differences become eroticized and commodified inequalities. The exotic is manufactured into the erotic, both privately in consumers' imaginations and quite publicly by entire industries that make money off of this desire for difference. Let me be clear. These differences between sex workers in the developing world and sex tourists traveling from the developed world are essential in distinguishing sexscapes in the developing world from red light districts or other sites where paid sex is available in the developed world. So too are the radiating effects of consuming practices of paid sex that undergird social and economic life in sexscapes. Within sexscapes, the sex trade becomes a focal point of a place, and the social and economic relations of that place are filtered through the nightly and daily selling of sex to foreigners. In contrast, the sex trade in red light districts in the developed world, such as Frankfurt, Rome, or Brussels, or New York, by no means define social and economic life outside of these districts, nor do the female citizens of these places necessarily become associated with sexual availability or proficiency. As Altman notes in his book Global Sex, although sex, quote, is a central part of the political economy of all large cities, few cities can base their economies on sex. When sexscapes emerge within a globalized economy, globalized hierarchies of race, class, gender, citizenship, and mobility create undeniable power differentials between the actors in these geographic spaces, which in turn give them unequal opportunities. Sosua offers different and often uneven opportunities for foreigners and locals and men and women, while race and age are factors in the differentiation of power. The asymmetries and inequalities that result from the mix of differences in Sosua reveal the unevenness that Appadurai describes in his discussion of modernity as, quote, decisively at large, irregularly self-conscious, and unevenly experienced. In this sexscape, the buyers eroticize these differences, particularly gendered and racialized differences, as part of their paid sex experiences. Meanwhile, the sellers often struggle to capitalize on these differences. And one way is through their performance of love. Beyond the assumed transaction of sex and money, complex politics of relationships are at work in the encounters between Sosua sex workers and sex tourists. While the sex workers represent themselves as sexually desirable and available to both attract and to anchor sex tourists to their own life and future, they also deploy love strategically. This role-playing is not without costs, however, as sex workers find themselves both exploited and exploiter in a cascade of customers, suitors, boyfriends, and partners. Dominican sex worker strategies to get ahead through Sosua's sex trade with foreign tourists, successful or not, can be viewed as an example of what Michael Smith and Luis Garnizo label transnationalism from below. Their strategies often hinge on their performance of love. Of course, the sex trade in any locale relies on the charade that sex workers desire their clients and enjoy the sex. Yet in Sosua's sexscape, some sex workers also pretend to be in love. Sex workers candidly admit that these relationships are por residencia and not por amor. And in this distinction, Sosuan sex workers' use of sex and marriage has a highly strategic element. With so many financial demands on them as single mothers, nearly every sex worker I met was a mother, and so few well-paying jobs available to them, Dominican sex workers who perform well at being in love have much at stake. Keeping transnational ties open is a daily task for some women. Many send faxes simultaneously to 4 or 5 foreign clients with whom they have ongoing relationships. For some, dropping by the fax office, which is the national phone company, to check if they have received any faxes is a daily ritual. Those considered lucky receive faxes instructing them to pick up money at the Western Union office in downtown Sosua. Others receive word that their European or Canadian client slash boyfriend is planning a return visit. The most envied women receive a letter of invitation essential to obtaining a tourist visa to visit a client in his home country. Sex workers' active emotional labor is clear in their performance of love in their faxes. Sex workers less experienced at building transnational relationships come to their colleagues such as Elena, who has a proven track record of receiving money wires and return visits from clients. Elena has helped compose letters and faxes for women who were uncertain about what to do with the addresses, fax numbers, and telephone numbers clients gave them. She helped a sex worker, Carmen, for example, write a letter to a Belgian client who had sent her a money wire and then abruptly stopped corresponding with her. Carmen came to Elena because at the time, Elena was living with Jürgen and was experienced, indeed successful, at transnational courting. Elena's advice was simple and centered on Carmen's performance of love. She told her, "You have to write that you love him and that you miss him. Write that you cannot wait to see him again. Tell him you think about him every day." Following Elena's guidelines, Carmen composed the following letter, which I helped her translate into English because his English was better than his Spanish. "Dear so-and-so, I have been thinking of you every day and have been waiting for a fax to hear how you are. I got your money wire, thanks, but I still want to see you. Please send me a fax at the following number, and if possible, a fax number where I can reach you. I miss you very much and think of you all the time. I love you very much. I wait to hear from you. I hope you come to visit again very soon. Many kisses, Carmen." Carmen never heard from this client again. Sensing which men are not already married and are likely to continue corresponding and to return for future vacations, the most certain first step to receiving an invitation to visit Europe or Canada, often proves an elusive skill. While sorting through all the pictures and letters from her European clients, Nancy, for example, commented on which ones seemed the most serious about keeping in touch. She pronounced several too young and thus not likely to follow through on the relationships. Nancy had honed her ability to detect which transnational suitors were worth pursuing during her 4 years in Sosua. She had been receiving money wires on and off from 5 or 6 European men at the same time. Her many and varied transnational ties were envied and difficult to replicate, yet many tried. Nancy kept a bundle of letters and faxes stashed away in a spare pocketbook. She also had photos of the men back home and photos of her with the men during their vacation in Sosua. Taped to her wall were photos of at least 15 different foreign men. Several had returned to Sosua to see Nancy and expressed interest in bringing her to Europe and marrying her. Expressing her love for them and how much she missed them were central themes in Nancy's performance of love with her suitors. Now, a few words about the sex trade as a migration strategy. Poor women used the sex trade as a first step to marriage and greater financial security in other sex tourist destinations. Kamala Kampadu, for example, writes about migrant Colombian and Dominican women who work in the sex trade in Curaçao's Campo Alegre Mirage and whose work with a client might develop, quote, into a close and intimate relationship that leads to marriage. These women also might pay to acquire Dutch citizenship by marrying, which means that migrant women could stay and work legally as a sex worker in Curaçao or travel to Europe without restriction. Sylvia Chant and Kathy McKilwain also write about the sex trade as a route to marriage and sometimes to migration between Europeans and Filipino women. Much like their Dominican counterparts, Filipino sex workers perceive a better life for themselves and their children in Europe. And like their Dominican counterparts, these Filipino women are locked out of opportunities for legal migration. With much of any tourist experience relying on fantasy, Edward Bruner's description of touristic border zones as performative spaces calls attention to the performative aspects of tourist encounters. He writes, "The touristic border zone is like empty space, an empty stage waiting for performance time for the audience of tourists and for the native performers. Tourists on vacation often engage in behavior and activities they would never engage in at home, such as paying for sex, or as Deborah Pruitt and Suzanne Lafont have observed in Jamaica, having cross-racial relationships. When I interviewed male tourists in Sosua, they often told me they'd never had paid for sex at home, but since they were on vacation, they thought, why not?" Chant and McElwain also found that some foreign men who had not intended to pay at the outset to pay for sex buy sex in bars in the Philippines because of, quote, peer pressure. One man boasted to his friends, for example, that he had bought 5 women in one night. In encounters between locals and foreign tourists, locals often have more practical goals, such as laying the groundwork to receive money wires from tourists once they return to Europe, and might need to perform for tourists to achieve these goals, whereas foreign tourists primarily seek fun and pleasure. Relationships in Sosua por Residencia also can be a kind of stage upon which Dominicans resist racial hierarchies, as well as inequalities based on gender, class, and citizenship. For example, the strategizing of Dominican women with Sosua sex trade sometimes has economically advantageous results. Some clients have paid for the education of the children of their girlfriend or have helped a sex worker get a fledgling business off the ground, such as a clothing store or a hair salon. In these cases, sex in a post-colonial context, much like in a colonial context, can be used, as Anne Stoller writes, as a vehicle to master a practical world. Because any use of sex between black local women and white foreign men in a post-colonial context is, as Stoller describes, and she's building on Franz Fanon here, a transfer point of power tangled with racial exclusions in complicated ways, today's sex trade is inextricably linked with the violent colonial history for Hispaniola's women. In the relationships between sex tourists and sex workers, there are similarities to the relationships between the colonizer and the colonized. I do not mean to suggest, however, that Dominican sex workers or resort workers are enslaved, but want to underscore that they stand to lose more materially than love gone awry. Of course, not every Dominican worker in Sosua's tourist economy tries to parlay access to foreign tourists into a marriage proposal and visa sponsorship, yet many are perceived as doing so. Sosuans, both Dominicans and foreign residents, and Dominicans who live outside of Sosua, brand as Sankeys a wide range of men who do not trade their bodies for money. The word Sankey Panky arrived from Los Hanky Pankies, so they're referred to as Sankey Pankies. For example, young, good-looking Dominican men who have migrated to work in Sosua's hotels, bars, and beaches often are glibly referred to or derided as Sankeys. male resort workers, particularly activity directors, the guys who organize dance contests and beach volleyball, they are often talked about as Sankeys. By referring to male resort workers as Sankey Pankeys, Sisuans see these men as prostituting themselves, as well as sacrificing love for migration. The term is now loosely used throughout the DR to refer to Dominican men who hit on tourist women, especially women older than they. Female resort workers, too, undergo public scrutiny and risk being stereotyped as a puta, a whore, but usually from Dominicans outside of Susua. As Susuans know that most of the women who clean, serve food, and cook in the hotels and other tourist businesses are from Susua or other nearby towns. Susuans also know that women who enter the sex trade are not from Susua, but migrate from towns throughout the island. However, to Dominicans outside of Susua, women's claims that they work in Susua's hotels and restaurants can appear to be a cover story for working in the sex trade. Indeed, most sex workers I interviewed concealed their participation in the sex trade from their families and neighbors by claiming instead to work in Susua's hotels and restaurants. Without the transnational connections that can grow out of relationships with foreigners, faxes, money wires, clients returns visits, and the possibility of traveling to or moving to a client's home countries, Susua's sex trade would be no different from sex work in any other Dominican town. Susua's sex trade also stands apart from many other sex tourist destinations in the developing world because it does not involve pimps or the coercion of women into selling sex, and therefore allows sex workers a good deal of control over their working conditions. I do not suggest that these women do not risk rape, beatings, arrest, and HIV infection. The sex trade can be dangerous, and Susua's trade is no exception. However, Dominican women are not trafficked into Susua's sex trade, but usually are drawn to it through female social networks of family and friends who work or have worked in it. The absence of pimps in Susua is critical to sex workers' lives. Without them, Susuan sex workers keep all their earnings essentially working freelance. They decide how many hours they will work, with whom, and for what price. Susua's sex trade allows women more choices than they would have in other sites in the DR. Despite sex workers strategizing, however, a recurring story seems to unfold. Most sex workers in Susua end up just getting by rather than improving their own or their children's lives. Dominican women's migration strategies cannot work, for example, unless the European or Canadian client follows through on his promises of visa sponsorships or marriage. At any time, these men could stop sending money wires or decide to withhold help in the visa process. Since the late 1980s, when Europeans began vacationing in Susua in significant numbers, only a modest number of European men have married Dominican women, let alone sponsor their migration to Europe. And while stories circulate in sex worker circles about women living in Europe with former clients turned husbands, nearly every sex worker also recounts stories in which foreign men break their promises to Dominican women. Particularly striking about women's participation in Susua's sex trade is the impermanence of their successes and failures. Foreign men are as unpredictable about stopping the transmission of money wires as they are about sending them. Promises to sponsor a woman's visa can go unfulfilled, and of course, marriages can come to an end. Moreover, the women themselves move in and out of sex work. Kamala Kempadu also has observed that commercial sex is not always a steady activity, but might occur in conjunction with other income-generating activities. It can be an activity that women and men take up for short periods or as part of an annual cycle of work. In Susua's sex trade, women engaging in paid commercial sex with foreign tourists do not simultaneously work in other income-generating activities. However, former sex workers may combine paid work outside the sex trade with love work, a transactional approach to romantic and sexual relationships with foreign men as boyfriends. And of course, in sex work and the relationships that grow out of it, both long-term relationships and marriage, are business transactions. Sex workers and former sex workers do not see these relationships with clients as restricting their sexual or romantic lives. Rather, the sex workers maintain sexual and possibly romantic relationships with Dominican men while they simultaneously build and maintain a roster of transnational suitors. Only a few women I met during my first trip to Sosua in 1993 were still working in Sosua's sex trade 10 years later. Most had long since returned to their families in towns and cities throughout the island. Those who stayed in Sosua had moved on from sex work. Some married Dominican men, usually a man who was their boyfriend while they were in sex work. These marriages, sex workers explain, are for love. Others still look to foreign men for resources and visas. I could never have predicted back in 1993 that some of them who had no ties to men overseas and who were not actively seeking to establish them would eventually marry foreign men and move to Europe. And of course, the reverse has happened. Women whose relationships with a foreign man seem fairly secure have experienced the disillusion of that relationship, resulting in the woman's return migration from Europe to the DR and downward mobility. So a few words about life after sex work before I finish. Former sex workers who stay on in Sosua rather than return to their home villages might continue to look for foreign men, but this time as boyfriends, not as clients. Like the liaisons that grew out of women's participation in the formal sex trade, these relationships, they candidly explain, also are for practical reasons. We cannot call post-formal sex work relationships sex work in the strict sense of the term, since their boyfriend or husband does not hand them money after each sexual act, but a transaction inspires nonetheless. Years after Elena and her friend Mary left the sex trade, foreign men still figured in their income strategies. Elena's life, like that of so many poor women's lives, has been full of changes, some as a result of her decisions and actions, and other as a result of forces out of her control. After working as a waitress in several of Sosua's restaurants, dancing in bachata contests, and playing successfully various illegal pyramid schemes and lotteries, Elena married a German man she met while she was a waitress. She calculated that this marriage por residencia was the only way that she could establish an economically secure life for her family. In her nearly 10 years of living in Sosua's sexscape, Elena had seen thousands of foreign men hanging out in Sosua's bars and nightclubs looking to have sex, and in some cases romance, with Dominican women. She has watched countless Dominican women and men migrate to town from throughout the island to find work and or to meet foreign lovers. And she had said goodbye to friends as they moved to Europe with foreign men. In short, Elena knew, as well as any veteran of Sosua's sex trade, that unless she married a foreign man who could sponsor her overseas migration, she would continue to live hand to mouth. She busied herself that spring with the details of getting a visa to visit her husband, who lived permanently in Germany, as the first step to moving there with her family. Yet more changes were to come for Elena. Elena's new German husband is no longer in her life. She's convinced that he was mentally unstable because he insisted that they marry after knowing one another for only a few weeks, and then he left Sosua never to return again. They speak on the phone occasionally, but Elena is sensible enough to recognize that it is foolish to wait for him to send money, let alone for his help with a visa. In fact, she waits for nobody and instead solves problems on her own when they arise. After working for a few months at a bar in downtown Sosua, she quit because the German bar owner paid poorly and was verbally abusive to her and to the other Dominican employees, calling them stupid and incompetent. Since then, she has been working at another bar on the beach with her friend Mari. Elena selected this job because the owner, a Dutch citizen, works most of the year in Santo Domingo, and in his absence, she manages the bar and answers to no one. She continues to be the sole breadwinner, taking care of her two children, and she has been helping out one of her older sisters who lives with her and has worked cleaning hotel rooms only occasionally. Elena, then 29, nor her friend Mari, then 30, had been in the formal sex trade for years. They do not go to bars to find clients who are looking to pay money in exchange for sex. Yet sex and romance, or the performance of romance and love with foreign men, is still an earning strategy for them. Mari had lived in Germany with a German man she married. left him, and then moved back to Saussure, where she took up with the Dutch man Edgar. Quite unexpectedly, Mari's German husband followed her to Saussure. A quiet man in his early to mid-60s, Klaus decided to live half the year in Saussure because, he explained, referring to Mari and her daughter, his wife and daughter were here. Although Klaus is not the biological father of Mari's daughter, he is a very caring and generous father, according to Elena and others. Mari is unimpressed, however, and is bored with Klaus. She had initially left him in Germany because she did not love him. But his move to Saussure has translated into greater material comfort for Mari and her daughter. The three of them live together, renting the second floor of a cement house that has the nicest kitchen I had ever seen on the Dominican side of the Saussure beach, with a refrigerator, a stove, a sink with running water, formica countertops, and wooden cabinets. Mari explains that she continues to work at the bar on the beach with Elena as a way to, quote, get out of the house, but most afternoons Klaus is there anyway. He watches her flirt with male customers, usually younger than he. He sits quietly while Mari bounces from one customer's lap to another, boisterously teasing them as they lavish attention on her. Mari has sex with Klaus, and in exchange he pays the bills for her and her daughter to live well. Her countertops and matching cabinetry, which none of her friends' home have, are symbols of their arrangement. Mari, however, risks having no long-term benefits from this relationship. If she and Klaus split up, she is likely to end up empty-handed, just like Elena when Jürgen, the German man who fathered her son that I mentioned in the opening, kicked her out and eventually sold off the furniture he had purchased. Mari would have to leave behind the living room furniture set, the television, and, of course, the kitchen. Klaus has given Mari jewelry, including a sizable gold heart necklace with four small rubies that she could always pawn. Moreover, since Klaus pays all household expenses, Mari could save the money she earns at the bar. But unlike her girlfriends, nearly every day Mari has on a new outfit, which provokes criticism from Elena and her sister. Elena says, Mari loves money. It's all she cares about. She spends any money she gets. And they emphasize, she spends it only on herself. Whereas Elena had negotiated with Jürgen for him to pay for her daughter to attend private school, Mari has not tried to work out the same arrangements. In fact, Elena and her sister are very worried about Mari's daughter, since Mari often has left her in the care of others, a long and rotating list of female family members scattered throughout the island, and friends, including Elena and her sister. Elena took care of Mari's daughter while Mari lived in Germany, and not once, Elena explained, did Mari send money to help with the girl's care. Mari's obvious impatience with Klaus, indicated by the rolling of her eyes when he is around and the silent treatment she gives him, along with her flagrant flirting with other foreign men, does not bode well for their relationship. Klaus is also well aware that Mari is involved with her Dutch boyfriend Edgar, also in his early 60s, with whom she had been living in Saussure after she left Klaus in Germany. So a few final words. Today, after her relationship with both Klaus and Edgar collapsed, Mari lives in a smaller apartment with her daughter, and Elena married a Dominican man in a consensual union and had a baby girl. But this relationship is strained because he has another family in a nearby town. Both women still work on the beach where they meet foreign men every day. This access to foreigners provides them with opportunities to feign love and use sex as both a short-term earning strategy and long-term advancement strategies. In this sexscape, this kind of love work and the sex that is a part of it will continue to forge new meanings and uses for marriage, sex, and romantic love. Thank you.
Anyone have a question? How are you? I was wondering what the implications of having towns like Sisua where the sexscapes are, I guess, more women-run through women's networks and kind of, I don't know, less abrasive perhaps than if there were pimps and exploitation, blatant exploitation going on. What that bodes for kind of the transnational scape of human trafficking where, you know, clearly the two are connected in some way, even though this one perhaps is not as obviously exploitive as maybe human trafficking transnationally may be, and what the implications of, you know, having these sexscapes are in a broader context.
I don't want to be subversive, or do I? That's a great, very complex question, and I actually would propose that the two are not linked. I don't think the sex trade fuels the demand for human trafficking. The Bush administration says otherwise, and I'm writing a book on this right now. Unwittingly, this first book I wrote stands as a complete dispute to the entire anti-trafficking program that the State Department Trafficking in Persons Office has put together. Their position is that the demand, with a capital D, to buy women and children, and then they throw children in there, so you know it's pretty hard to argue against forced prostitution of children, that this is fueling human trafficking. I'm standing up here as a witness to one town in one place, I'm not saying everywhere, where adult women chose to migrate to this town to sell sex to people who would pay for it, and that they weren't coerced to sell this sex, and there weren't middlemen. So I see the two as not always connected. Of course, there are sites. And I wouldn't necessarily call sites where there is, as you said, sort of blatant exploitation of women and maybe children, sexscapes. Those are sites of exploitation, particularly some places that are very, where there's a lack of serious protections for women, where there are no sex worker activist organizations, and you know where unfortunately there are pedophiles who go to buy sex from kids. But this Sisua stands as an example of what happens in a lot of tourist sites and other places where adults are exchanging sex for money, and it's consensual and there's no coercion. But as I try to underscore throughout the book, that doesn't mean that women don't take a lot of risk. It's not necessarily always the first choice, the first labor choice for poor women. And that's why I write about the sex trade in this particular town as being not just a short-term survival strategy, but a long-term advancement strategy, since they fashion it into the possibility to migrate out off the island. Does that answer your question? Wind dance, yeah.
Fake. How does age and aging affect the ability of a woman to, quote, perform a certain kind of romance and femininity as well as the types of sexual practices she's willing to engage in? Since I'm assuming that younger women would have some advantages over middle-aged women. And is there an age cutoff at some point when you're no longer able to do this? And do older women move into, quote, management positions?
Well, there are really no management positions because there aren't brothels the way we think of them possibly here where there's businesses being managed. Yeah, it's definitely a young woman's game, which is why Elena and Madi, even at their in their late 20s, aren't in it anymore. The former sex workers I write about who still engage in love work, let's say their late 20s up through maybe 40-ish, who build a network of Dominican and foreign men who help with a variety of things. So, for example, I'm thinking of one woman who I didn't talk about who was probably in her mid-30s, who had two quasi-middle-class Dominican boyfriends, one of whom paid her rent every month and one of whom paid for her kids' school. She didn't see this as sex work. These were boyfriends. And she had been in the formal sex trade. She was very brutal with herself that she wouldn't be able to keep this up for much longer, that eventually these men or other potential suitors in the future would look for younger women. Yeah. Well, and that's why Madi, I mean, I write a lot in my book about gossip and the sort of script of motherhood that women were expected to adhere to, that they saved all the money to put into some kind of long-term goal, like building an addition on a house for parents or for themselves or financing kids' schools. And this one, and that's why Madi was so transgressive, because she was so blatantly spending the money on herself. So even if women were spending money on themselves, they were very, they would conceal it. But the woman I'm talking about who had these two Dominican boyfriends, she was mapping a way for her girls to get to college. I mean, there's no doubt that that was, she recognized that she would have so many hoops to jump through to gain access to, let's say, some kind of office job, that she was now investing in the next generation.
I wonder if these women also had boyfriends for love, not necessarily, foreigners, but like in the Dominican Republic, would they have also relationships with men just for love, or they would only have encounters with men? I mean, it's not something you can determine, but did you hear from women that they were interested in some men just for love?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned in the paper that women had Dominican boyfriends and husbands in consensual unions that they described as, you know, being in love with. And there were, I didn't talk about this today, but there were women who fell in love with some of the guys that they, some of the foreign guys. But what I mentioned is that they were very careful not to almost admit that, because it would set them up as kind of naive, right? Because they had seen all of their girlfriends sort of get stranded by guys. So they're pretty careful with that. What anthropologists do is we try to find ourselves sort of all everywhere all the time, you know? And so there were times when I would show up people's houses and, you know, a boyfriend would still be in bed there. So you get a sense of ongoing relationships just by seeing, you know, who are you letting into your house all the time? Who are you essentially sharing a household with? And if that jived with what they were describing as sort of who was their main guy, right? And also this is tricky terrain for this particular group of women who were so proud. I mean, part of the script about sex work in Sisua is that you don't give your money out to men. It's part of this idea that there are no pimps. And so women were very careful in some ways, too, to not appear to be paying the rent for an ongoing Dominican boyfriend who might have been living with them. But again, you know, everyone sort of knew over time who was living with whom. And the women selling sex were making more money than anyone else in town. So obviously they would be paying the rent. But they, you know, they were careful to not appear to be bankrolling their boyfriends.
I'm wondering if there's a difference between in the ways in which men sex workers express their love work to their male, to their female European and Canadian lovers, and between the ways in which women express their love work to their workers. I'm wondering if in your research you see the difference between the gender ways in which they would express their love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me recommend a new book by Mark Padilla on the Sankey Pankies and male sex workers in the DR. And this has been written about by a number of scholars, some of whom I cited today. The language of love that men use when wooing foreign tourists, in Sosua, it's a little bit complicated. The Sankey, the men that were talked about as Sankey Pankies, in the early 90s, it was said, this was before I got there, it was said that they were seen all over the beaches, so these Afro-Caribbean men wooing white, middle-aged, at that point Canadian women. And it was said that they would be out in the bars and, you know, they'd be out on, I mean, it's Valentine's Day, kind of a date, you know. And the women, and there's some HIV researchers who have written about this, the women would not give the men money directly, but they would pay for the evening out. And then much like the sex workers, the female sex workers I write about, the female girlfriends / clients would send gifts once they got back to Canada or money and then return visits. And it's said that some of the Sankey Pankies eventually married these women and moved to Canada. And it's said that they're still living there today. How would I know this? But some of these guys are now legendary. And some of them have come back. They own, like, the motorcycle business in town. So folks point to them and say, you know, he went to Canada. You know, what do I know? I'm just reporting, you know, what I hear. The thing that gets complicated about the Sankeys is the police targeted the Sankeys. Now, these are black men, often with dreads, kind of buff. Dominican men usually, they're not, it's not an unlike a North American sensibility about the bodies. These were beach boys, okay? Tanned, buffed, dreads, playing a part to of an assumed white desire. And they literally were thrown in jail for, some say, you know, assumed to be prostitutes. The police at that point also claimed they were homosexuals. So this is very real through today that men, for example, I knew men who worked in a bank who would not have dreads because if they were walking somewhere in town, they could be arrested just for looking like they were Sankey Pankies, right? So we see these racialized crackdowns on assumed sexual practices, whether homosexual practices or paid sex. So the term today is more like what we would say here in the U.S. of being kind of a gigolo / con man. And I find it very interesting because the men are often in control on the dance floor and at the dinner table, and they're kind of, you know, as I said, bringing these women out on a date. Whereas it seems that what a lot of the German men want from Dominican women are these assumptions about Dominican women's sexuality as fierce and aggressive as opposed to buying sex in Asia, right? And Dominican women know this. And there's this sort of reversal of this gaze. You know, they really play it. They'll go out on the dance floor when the bars are kind of slow, and they'll work it. And they know, I had many a conversation where Dominican women told me that Dominicanness is hotness. You know, we are hot, we are caliente. You know, this pride, right? So this whole playing up of stereotypes that came out of the colonial encounter and systematic rape through slavery, right? And justifying this rape that these women were insatiable. So there's this play with that, and active play with it, because as I said, you kind of have, if there's a bar full of women, you have to work it. You have to somehow stand out. It's also said, and I have no way to prove this, that that there's some violence in the relationship. There has been some violence in the relationship between some of the Dominican men and the white women. So there's a lot of inversions and a lot at play, and much of this has to be behind closed doors so the guys don't get arrested. It's not that the women don't get arrested either. The police are out, and that when the police are out, everyone stays off the streets.
I have two quick questions. One is, what parts of the Dominican Republic are these Dominican sex workers coming from? And two, do you think that the Dominican people themselves don't consider this notion of sex trade as an issue? Because I'm from the Dominican Republic, and when I hear people talking about going to Susua to like find someone to find residence, it's not spoken of as an issue, as like, oh my God, you know, like it's this like happy thing, like I'm gonna go find residence and go to the United States or Europe or somewhere else.
Like any tourist town, it attracts folks from all over the island. So I would say, you know, folks are there from small towns in Santo Domingo and all over. I think that sex work is still stigmatized throughout the island. But if you're making good money in it, it really trumps any kind of stigma. I've done another project where I interviewed women, Dominican women, who were allegedly trafficked to Argentina and then sent back by the Argentine government to the island. And I went around the island and met them. And some of them weren't trafficked. They were economic migrants and experienced in economic free fall when the Argentine peso fell. And some really were trafficked. So I had an opportunity to go to some of these little sending towns that had been sending women over the years to Sosua, where I was. And I really got this sense of kind of these ghost towns, you know, places that there were no income-generating activities. And folks would bring me around these towns and always point to houses that were, you know, people would whisper that they were built with either drug money, money that women had earned in Europe, and it was assumed that they were in the sex trade, or money that women had earned on the island, and it was assumed that it was in the sex trade. So, but at the same time, there would be a sense of pride about the, you know, the size of the house, the satellite dish, et cetera. So I think that ultimately the stigma that can be associated with selling sex can be mitigated by the, you know, display of material comfort. Unfortunately, as I try to point out, that the signs of success are few and far between the success stories.
I just wanted to see if you could explain a little bit more about your use of sexscapes for this particular, as you were describing it as being part of the sort of a word that you had only applied to the developing world, as having these sexscapes as compared with the developed world, economically developed, that is. I was interested also in about how you explain that in relationship to this, what you seem to be arguing, which is that these women have agency, basically, that they're making these choices in some ways. But at the same time, this is a tourist industry that you describe as having just developed at the end of the 1980s, which is curiously frequented by a number of Germans who don't have a colonial relationship with this part of the world. So it is very interesting where in the U.S., for instance, we have this long history, historical relationship, a lot of Dominicans that live in the U.S. as well. I'm just curious about how this has been marketed, why it's being called a sexscape, and how this play between it being both about agency and choice, but also in some way about an economy that has changed, and how that has happened, how this is, you're able to say that the economy is completely dependent on this sex trade.
Sosua is a very small town, and There is a history of transnational ties to the area. United Fruit Company was up in the north of the DR, but left because it was not profitable in the beginning of the 20th century. Trujillo, one of the century's worst dictators, let in about 500 Jews from transit camps on their way to death camps during World War II to Sosua. So there is this history and these connections to Germany. And I had the privilege of interviewing some. They're called the settlers. I had the privilege of interviewing some of these original Jewish settlers who stayed. Many after the war left. They went to Israel or New York. When I talk about Sosua as a transnational border town, I don't literally mean it's on a border, but that it has this history of transnational connections. They're not just when the tourist trade came in the 1980s. And Germans, as you probably well know, unlike in the U.S., have a big chunk of vacation time. There's a lot written on how much they enjoy traveling. The travelers to Sosua initially were basically working class folks who very much fetishized brown skinned women and sun and no taxes. So what happened is there's this now large sort of expatriate neocolonial community of German speaking folks in Sosua who are new settlers. It was really word of mouth. And when I first started doing the research in the early 90s, first of all, I know this is hard for our students to think about this, but, you know, the people didn't use the internet and there weren't websites to buy all sorts of things. And I tracked from about the mid to the late 90s forward, really no mention of Dominican women in Sosua and sexual availability in this town, too. It's now on all these sex tourist, you know, websites. But the town has gone through a tourist cycle where most of the hotels in the town were just mom-and-pop hotels owned by individuals. And they can't compete with the larger all-inclusive hotels. And the town has really experienced a pretty big economic downturn. In terms of sexscapes, Elizabeth Bernstein and I have talked about this, a scholar at Barnard who writes on the sex trade in Europe, that Sosua, why is it that a white guy gets on a plane to buy sex from a brown woman in another place when he can, if he lives in a major city, he can go into the red light district and probably buy sex from a brown woman from that same country, not all cities. This is very intriguing to me. And I think a lot of what goes on for sex tourists who go to small places, not big established orchestrated sex tourist sites, is that they can really kind of be the big man. And they get to know the bar owners, especially the bar owners are fellow countrymen. And they get to know
some of the women that work the bar, and then you might have your one or two sweeties that you return to see. And it's a sense of, I think it blurs the question the young lady in the back in the red was asking about men exchanging sex or selling sex from women, and sort of that blurring of the transactional aspects of it, so that it more emphasizes the love and emotional, the appearance of dating. And I saw some of these return sex tourists who had ongoing relationships with women there very much enjoy coming back to their routine, coming back to where they were known. And I think that's a part of a sex scape. And of course, what undergirds all of that is this inequality and this performance that women, as we hear, are playing these guys. Or are they kind of in love? I mean, but ultimately, these guys can come and go. These women can't, because you can't fly off the island without a visa. So, you know, and that's where Apadurai's work has its limitations, because he talks about these global cultural flows in the celebratory fashion and never talks about the social and economic realities of those who can't imagine, or they can imagine what it would be like to live in Europe, but they can't get there until a guy helps sponsor the visa and buys the plane ticket.
So, and are you seeing sex games as a place of exploitation?
Not always. potentially, but both ways. The women are exploiting the men as well. I would say more of inequality. Now that I'm writing on trafficking, I'm very wary of the word exploitation. I would say they're places of inequality, but that women can parlay that inequality. Yes, and the other thing, the women in Chicago and the other places you named, they're not going to be submissive. And the traditional gender scripts prevail. It's very interesting in Sosua, because I just said these women are the highest income earners in town. With income comes decision-making. They still fulfill... from the German men's standpoint, traditional understandings of women, of their role. And even though the white German women are not in this social space, they are in the men's imagination as this counterpart to what they're leaving behind. And I was often told they're not only, sometimes fieldwork isn't fun. My least comfortable moments were dealing with often drunk men telling me how white German women were terrible sexual partners, you know, terrible, cold, awful, these feminist demanding women. So this exoticization, not just of the brown body, but of the brown body that without hesitation cooks and cleans for you and fulfills these longed for traditional female tasks. Well, not always, but the men usually get a kick as well out of what they see as these women playing these roles, but giving the men a little bit of a run for their money.
but, you know, also it's very important the men go home to their lives. These are relationships that when you go somewhere, you have a relationship with somebody, and it's bounded, it's 2 weeks, and then you're going to go home, right? How demanding can these women be, right? I mean, you only have to put up with, I witnessed many fights between Elena and Jürgen, and, you know, Jürgen leaves, and he leaves behind this son, who he eventually denies as his son because the son is brown, and Jürgen says then Jürgen's racism comes out. And Jürgen leaves. We don't know where Jürgen is today. So what are these sexscapes? Is it exploitation? There's this inequality. Elena can't get on a plane and find the father. Elena can't employ a lawyer to make this man pay child support.
I guess mine is kind of a two-part question. And the first part is, as a researcher there, how did you feel that kind of your dynamic as a person from the United States entering into this community and to these women's networks, how did that play out? And then second, I was just wondering why you're so hesitant to use this word exploitation, and if you can explain a little bit more your resistance to that word.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I worked with this NGO, and I entirely relied on the trained peer educators that were called health messengers to bring me around and sort of, you know, vouch for me. And as those many of you know who are in maybe field research classes, that you need to, I think, make yourself kind of small. I am small, literally. But when you're entering other people's worlds, just to make yourself as small as you can and to listen and to just always be there and be reliable. I owe a huge debt. Elena actually was my main field research assistant. I just talked to her the other day. And the proceeds from the book go to an education fund for sex workers and their children. And in terms of this word exploitation, I hesitate because I don't see selling sex as inherently exploitative. I see sex work as what the name implies. It's a form of labor that if adults are choosing it, it should be protected and safe. And there are so few labor protections for sex workers throughout the world that then exploitation, you know, can happen. But in the language of folks who are anti-prostitution, they talk about sex work as only being, you know, exploitative. So I don't share that view.
I have one comment and a question. And I agree with you. I don't see it as exploitative also. And an anecdote that I would say to that was in the last Mexico, 5 years ago, there was a riot once they called themselves sexual servidores, right? Or sexual servitors. That was because they had a riot for all of this readjustment of life. Mexico has social security system. And so if the town is not giving the services that everybody else had because they didn't consider it legitimate work. And so they literally rioted and took over the mayor's office until he conceded. Right? And there's things all over the Mexican space. Of course, we never did that stuff up here. Right? In that case, it takes a different aspect that we perhaps face. That's the problem. I would agree with your statement, but I would see it. The second statement is if you did or had used, or one of the people that used, GIS technology to track some of the information that you have and see of it in terms of like a approaching geographical level.
I don't even know what GIS technology is.
Well, I think it might be useful for you because you're talking about all these migration stuff. If you fit within Dominican Republic, or maybe it's Espanola, if it's a way of tracking information on map, electronically. And so you can do different layers of information. You might want to look at it, I think it would be really enhance your research. And of course, you can always get people at your school to help you.
It's very intriguing. This project I'm done with. I'm now looking at much more complicated migration of people from all over the world who have sought to migrate to the U.S. and have ended up trafficked.
One of the things they've done with GIS technology, that people at other institutions have tracked, slave trip ship dockets from African American people coming to the United States. Trace where they came from, how they overlap, the routes that they take, and they can layer different kinds of information.
Yes. I think this gentleman raises a very interesting point, and I'm going to end here because I know it's time. That as I'm now writing on a top, no one usually cares about the Caribbean, the DR, and the sex trade. The book I'm writing now, and everybody cares about it, and it's on the front page of the newspaper. So now, the heat is on. And I would say that, and there's a lot of people writing about trafficking, and there's a lot of different methodologies being employed, and a lot of it is schlock. But the good thing is when you look at any issue, it should be approached by a number of different methodologies, which doesn't mean that, I'm trained as an anthropologist. What I do is right now, I sit in people's kitchens around the country, and we make dinner, and we sit in bed, and we talk. Just like the methodologies I employ in the DR. That sounds like a great methodological approach for maybe one of you going off to grad school to complement what I write. You can find the holes in my future book on trafficking. And it's just a really excellent place to end when particularly talking about migrations. I teach a class on migration. I tell kids in my class, we're reading anthropology, read some fiction, read some history, but you need to read broadly across disciplines, which is what the Clark Forum is all about. So here's some dissertation work for you all. Thank you very much.
I would just like to remind everyone that there is another event at 1 o'clock. It'll be on Written on the Body, Hair and Heritage in Black Europe by France Woodens Twine. And once again, please join me in thanking Denise Brennan for her talk.